Hi everyone, welcome to Room Now Live, and our special Room Now Live session here on Tuesday night rheumatology. Last week we had our first week where we were replaying content from Room Now Live here on TNR, where we focused last week on rheumatoid arthritis. This week we're going to do the psoriatic arthritis session. Both sessions, RA and PSA, were sponsored by AbbVie. AbbVie's been a long, long sponsor, prime sponsor of Room Now Live. Please be sure to thank your AbbVie rep for sponsoring Room Now Live. This is a really great session we're going to have here, where we're going to go over excerpts from three very strong lectures in our psoriatic arthritis hot topics session or pod. Our three speakers tonight are Dr. Alexis Ogdy from University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Leahy Eder from the University of Toronto, and Dr. April Armstrong from UCLA. She's a dermatologist, but speaks frequently to rheumatologists about therapies that we all use together. Again, the format here is I'm going to give you roughly about 15, 16 minutes from these 25-minute lectures. We'll take your questions at the end of each session. Please use the Q&A box to put in your question. And at the end, we'll review some questions that we sent out in a survey yesterday, all coming from this particular session. Our first speaker is going to be Dr. Alexis Ogdy. Alexis is a associate professor of medicine and epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania. Great speaker, highly knowledgeable. We asked Alexis to talk about the many guidelines that surround psoriatic arthritis and spondyloarthritis and to compare and contrast them. She begins by going over all the new therapies that have been approved for these disorders. And then next, she's going to get into the differences in the different guidelines. Listen up.
So there are only three classes, though, that are approved for axial disease, AxSpA. And so those bubbles are here. That's TNF inhibitors, IL-17 inhibitors, and JAK inhibitors. So this is relevant because when we talk about patients with psoriatic arthritis with axial disease, it's going to narrow the therapies really quickly. So I'm going to show you that as we walk through the different treatment recommendations. Note here that oral small molecules like methotrexate, sulfasalazine are not part of the landscape for AxSpA. I saw a patient yesterday coming in for a second opinion about AxSpA management, and she was like, "I feel all these therapies, and I've never felt very good. I've been on methotrexate, sulfasalazine, and leuflatamide," and I was like, "Oh my gosh, you have axial disease. These are not treating your axial disease." So just to keep in mind that those are not axial disease treatments. So before we launch into what the ACR, EULAR, and GRAPPA say, I'm going to put together my own little schematic. So this is just my way of thinking about treatment of psoriatic arthritis. And then I'll tell you how I think all the guidelines kind of map onto this. So I have a patient with psoriatic arthritis, and this is not, I like to select patients, but I really like to select therapies. So excuse the title change up there. So this is my thought process in selecting a therapy for a patient. So I have a patient with active skin and joint disease, my patient that I just mentioned. I'm going to then triage my therapy selection by thinking about how severe his psoriasis is first. I put an asterisk there because it's really according to the patient. Interestingly, I have these patients come in sometimes and they feel fantastic and their skin is terrible, in my opinion, but their skin doesn't bother them. And the converse, sometimes people have just a tiny bit of psoriasis and it's, let's say, along the scalp line or maybe it's genital psoriasis, so I can't see it at all if I'm looking at them with clothes on. But that psoriasis is so impactful for them because maybe they're 25 and trying to find a partner and they really hate that part of their skin. So being involved. So this is according to the patient, moderate to severe skin disease versus mild. And then from there, I'm going to think about do they have axial disease because that matters for what therapy I select, as I just showed you on the previous slide. That narrows us to three classes pretty quickly. Then from there, I'm going to put this through a set of filters. So what are the previous therapies they've been on? Do they have enthesitis? Do they have concomitant IBD or uveitis? Do they have comorbidities? And what are their preferences for therapy? Sometimes our young patients want oral therapies over injectable therapies. Some people want long intervals between therapies. Some people actually want an injection every week so that they know that they're going to take it on Sundays every week. So after I've kind of gotten this together, then I have my piece of paper that I hand people that has all the therapies written out with some of the side effects and some key things about them, like dosing. And then I just circle what are the different options given this, and then the patient and I can have a shared decision-making discussion about what's next. We actually created a website that does this. It's on our Pac-Man website. It's called psoriasisdecisionaid.com if you're interested. We haven't updated it for the last 2 years, so we need to add the new therapies because it took us 2 years to migrate it from one website to the next. But hopefully in the next 6 months or so, that will be up to date. All right, so now I've told you like how I think about psoriatic arthritis treatment guidelines. Let's take a look at the different sets. I'm going to pause here to say that some people call them guidelines, some people call them recommendations. So GRAPPA, for example, is recommendations, ACR is guidelines, just because there may be legal implications if you do something against guidance. So some people use recommendations instead. In reality, these are all recommendations. So what are these most helpful for? Treating the patient that is in front of us. But actually, they're really helpful for insurance as well. So especially ACR, NPF guidelines can really help in the United States with an insurer to send them if it's relevant. And then take a look at the years. So we have 2019, 2021, and 2023. Each of them really was done in the year prior to that. So what are some overall similarities and differences? In general, if you read the general principles about treatment from any one of the three guidelines, they're the same. They're just different sets of words there. Treat to target is mentioned in all three of them. I'll talk a little bit more about that. The importance of axial disease and psoriasis in selecting a therapy is in all three of them as well. And so you'll see that as I kind of move through, but that's why I highlighted that in my process of decision making. There's a more limited focus on the CS DMARDs versus oral small molecules. I'll talk about that difference in 1 second, but if you look at all three recommendations, over time, our reliance on methotrexate as a first-line therapy is diminishing. The importance of taking comorbidities into account is noted in all three, but dealt with in slightly different ways. And the importance of a derm-rheum collaboration is noted in all three. Now, what's different? They do use different methods for guideline development. So the ACR is, especially the 2018-2019 version, very strict grade guidelines, which has some is present, use B, and so on. So it's used as conditions instead. And then finally, the attention to comorbidities is slightly different. In previous versions, EULAR didn't really address comorbidities that much. It was more like consider comorbidities in making a decision. I think that has amplified with the 2023 guidelines, which are still not yet published. All right, so let's start with the ACR treatment guidelines, published in 2019 but developed in 2018. Abatacept and tofacitinib were only in abstract form at that time. So these papers were not even published yet when these treatment guidelines were available. So you'll see a reliance on TNF, IL-12, 23, and IL-17, and that's just because those were the only three classes of biologics we had at the time. Some non-pharmacologic therapies were addressed, including physical therapy, occupational therapy, smoking cessation, weight loss, massage therapy, and exercise. In general, again, in the ACR treatment guidelines, there's no pathway, there's no nice figure at the beginning. It's just pairwise comparisons for each different scenario. But within that, there's a lot of rich text within the conditions, which is not something you can easily pull up and read during a treatment, a visit with a patient, for example. But if you have the time to go back and read, it tells you a lot about the evidence we have in the setting of fatty liver disease, for example. And then there's recommendations are given a strong or a conditional view or kind of label. Strong means that there's really good evidence for this. Conditional means there's not enough evidence to clearly show a difference, so it's considered conditional. One of the key things that I think that the ACR-MPS guidelines contributed was a description of what is severe psoriatic arthritis and what is severe psoriasis. I use this all the time for insurance claims. So, or I used to, I don't have to do it as much anymore. But one of the nice things is we have this then written out so you can kind of think about, does my patient have severe disease or not? As if they have erosive disease, markers of inflammation that are elevated, long-term damage, highly active disease that causes a major impairment in quality of life. So my patient yesterday, while his shoulders were the main thing that were active, he can't do his job. So most of his job is on a ladder. He actually operates cranes. And so he needs to be able to climb up. So he's got a major impairment in his ability to work if we don't treat him for his disease. Active dactylitis or enthesitis at multiple sites, function limiting PSA at a few sites, or rapidly progressive disease. And then severe psoriasis, we get to what I was saying before, which is if it has a major emotional impact, for example, genital psoriasis, that can be considered severe, or a highly visible area like the face or the hands, for example. So within the ACR treatment recommendations, there are only five strong recommendations out of about 80 recommendations altogether. Those were basically in patients with IBD, don't use drugs that don't work in IBD. Heed box warnings, so don't treat a patient with serious infections with a TNF inhibitor, and that smoking is still bad for everyone, so tell your patient to stop smoking. So, you have not a lot of strength in these recommendations, but if you look back at the data we had available at that time, 5 years ago now, there's a lot less data. This is what one of the treatment recommendations looked like. This is treatment naive active psoriatic arthritis. So among those patients, you compared starting a TNF inhibitor over an oral small molecule, starting a TNF inhibitor over an IL-17, or starting a TNF inhibitor over an IL-23 inhibitor in patients with active treatment naive disease. This was the first set of recommendations that was very clear about in a patient with more significant active psoriatic arthritis, use a biologic first. And so this helped shift some of that. I don't know about you, but at least in Pennsylvania, they actually took heed of these guidelines. And then for our patients who are on Medicaid, we're able to start a biologic first often. So these can be really helpful in sending to an insurer. The ACR treatment recommendations really kind of hinged on two different outcome measures, the ACR 20 being the primary outcome, because it's the primary outcome in most of our trials. I think stepping back a little, if we think about making treatment decisions for our patients, would you really want to do it based on an ACR 20 response in a trial that is really structured to look at a drug versus placebo? Probably not. But again, this shows us where we are in our data today. So hopefully we'll gain more data over the next several years and that will help us make better decisions that with meaningful outcomes for clinicians and patients. The ACR treatment recommendations did take into account MDA in some of the analyses as well, or minimal disease activity. That's achieving five of the seven circles here. All right, so let's move on to GRAPPA treatment recommendations. I told you in GRAPPA, we break down the different domains, and then we select a therapy based on what domains the patient has active. The difference between 2015 and 2021 was adding or splitting the domain of comorbidities into associated conditions, meaning IBD and uveitis, and then the rest of the comorbidities. Then for each of these different groups, you have a box with the therapies that are good for those conditions. There's no A over B here. It's just these are the therapies that you can use in these specific circumstances. So take the most significant groups like axial disease and let's say psoriasis or nail disease, and then find something that's going to be in all three of those boxes, and then use that treatment ideally, or one of those sets of treatments ideally. And then you filter that again through the comorbidities. What is it, for example, if methotrexate is one that is coming up as an option and a patient has fatty liver disease, that's not an ideal treatment for that patient. If the patient, if etanercept is one of the options and the patient has uveitis or IBD, not an ideal therapy for that patient. So you use that to filter. And then periodically reevaluate how the patient is doing. Moving on to EULAR. So this is just again their therapy schematic, but what you can see is what's added is bimekizumab, because that was actually it says pending in here, but it was approved in 2023 in Europe for PsA and axSpA. So that was able to be added, as well as risankizumab, which wasn't yet approved, I think, by the time of the GRAPPA guidelines were published. Now, actually, the EULAR guidelines used to look fairly different from GRAPPA, but they looked a lot more similar. And you don't see a schematic here yet because it's not yet published. This is still from just the abstract presentation at EULAR 2023. So there was an increased focus on the treat-to-target approach and aiming at remission or LDA. That's not new to EULAR, but they kind of made a more of an emphasis in this particular set of guidelines. They limited the time on NSAIDs before continuing to a therapy. They suggested still starting methotrexate or CFDMARD first, but if the patient had more severe disease or axial disease, for example, then start with a biologic therapy. They didn't order the biologic therapies. In previous versions, they have said a TNF inhibitor first, but they didn't order that as much here. They did say JAK inhibitors are an option after a biologic or if a biologic use is inappropriate. They included apremilast as an option for mild disease or when a biologic or JAK inhibitor was inappropriate. They focus on enthesitis and axial disease in the same way that GRAPPA has. And then they also said consider psoriasis, uveitis, IBD when selecting. And then there was somewhat of an increased emphasis on safety, especially around comorbidities. So you can see that at least those two are kind of starting to merge together a little bit and look quite similar. One other slight difference, this is a nice paper from Laura Gosek and Laura Coates, just recently published, in which they kind of break down a couple of key differences. One other difference with EULAR is that they focus more on oligoarticular disease versus polyarticular disease. And they said, if you have polyarticular disease, go right to therapy. And they still said a CFDMARD first. Whereas if you have oligoarticular disease, you could start with an NSAID or local glucocorticoid injections and then proceed to a CFDMARD and then over to the biologics. With GRAPPA, you could try NSAIDs and glucocorticoids, but you can slide right over to therapy and you can select any one of the therapies. In all of these recommendations, one of the nice things is there's an increased focus on obesity as a key and important comorbidity.
Okay, I want to stop there because Alex is going to go on to a few other things that don't add much to what she's already said about the differences in the guidelines. I want to underscore for you that she makes an early decision based on the extent of skin or joint disease and psoriatics and whether or not spondyloarthritis is present. Okay. We'll take questions from you along the way. We have one question here that I can address now. Oh, we were asked the speaker to repeat the website. It's a little late. She did this lecture back on the 27th of January. But again, the GRAPPA guidelines, the EULAR guidelines, and the ACR guidelines are all covered on Room Now. So go to Room Now and put in the search box. Put in GRAPPA guidelines and whatnot, you'll see not only an article about that, but also a link that'll take you to where you want to go. I hope that's helpful. Our next speaker is Dr. April Armstrong from UCLA. April's a very well-known dermatologist who does a lot of research, a lot of education on psoriasis and is, frequently a speaker at rheumatology programs. She understands our literature well. She begins by talking about what's her algorithm in making decisions, and she starts with the same point. Do they have, how much BSA, how much skin involvement by body surface area do they have? And then the next question is, do they have psoriatic arthritis? And that then becomes the beginning of the treatment algorithm that she uses in making her treatment decisions. So let's listen up to, again, Dr. April Armstrong, professor of dermatology, chief of dermatology at UCLA.
That is, when we think about the overall treatment of patients with plaque psoriasis, the first question that we actually ask is there active psoriatic arthritis? And if there is, then we are actually reverting where we're going for systemic therapies that can address the joints. So if you may have a patient who may have, for example, 0.5% body surface area of psoriasis. But if they have active psoriatic arthritis, our choice of therapy would be really considering the biologics and the oral medications. And then if they do not have psoriatic arthritis present, then we look at their skin in terms of the amount of involvement, then determine whether they should get topical therapies or targeted phototherapy versus systemic therapies. So I know that Dr. Ogdi nicely laid out the different domains that we want to think about with regards to psoriatic arthritis. And I think from a dermatologist perspective who, treats patients with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, the oftentimes the main question is, if I have a patient with psoriasis, they may present with peripheral psoriatic arthritis or axial psoriatic arthritis. How do I approach this? So I think about these three bubbles all the time, and I'll kind of tell you about a little bit about this. So this is the FDA-approved biologics for psoriasis. As you can see, there are 12 of these now, and pretty much all, nearly all of them are approved for psoriatic arthritis, with the exception of brodalumab and bimekizumab in our IL-17 category. Brodalumab is also approved for psoriatic arthritis outside of the U.S. And then for clotrimazole, is only approved for psoriasis as well. And here are the different categories of psoriatic arthritis pharmacotherapy options. And what I wanted to point out, as you communicate with your derm colleagues, you'll see some of them are very familiar with the therapies we share, but others may not be. And the ones that we don't use in dermatology as often in terms of in our psoriasis patients include the ones that I striked out. So you have, for example, we typically don't use sulfasalazine or leflunomide. And when we think about the biologic DMARDs, we also don't use golimumab or abatacept. And in terms of the targeted synthetic DMARDs, what we typically we don't do not use tofacitinib or upadacitinib in skin for skin disease alone. So I think understanding when you're communicating with derm colleagues, understanding their familiarity with the different medications can be very helpful. But the takeaway from this is actually there are a lot of crossover between the management of psoriasis and the management of psoriatic arthritis. Okay, so our polling question will have to do with this particular patient. So let's take a look at this patient. This patient has very classic plaque psoriasis. This is a patient that I saw in LA County and has about overall BSA of around 11%, PASI of 16, PG of 4, no active PSA that we can assess. And so let's take a look at, so pretend that you're a dermatologist here. And how would you approach this patient who has moderate to severe plaque psoriasis but no PSA? So I think I will. All right, I think we're almost approaching. We're Okay, wonderful. So let's see here. The number just keeps climbing. Okay, all right. So let's take a look at the results. So as you can see, there's a split in terms of the responses. The most popular answer is adalimumab, and I think adalimumab is a fine choice. Ixekizumab, risankizumab, and then lower options for apremilast and deucravacitinib. So I would say that for this patient with skin-limited disease, skin-only disease, who have moderate to severe plaque psoriasis, I'll present the data a little bit later on. But overall, we are looking at IL-17 or IL-23 classes, as they have very high skin efficacy, but certainly are depending on patients' preference for oral versus injectables, so we can think about the oral options. Adalimumab is the highest choice here, but we do have a number of head-to-head studies now showing that we have superiority of some of our other classes over TNF class now in the skin. Okay, first of all, I want to apologize that this is not a diagram of a joint. So this is skin pathophysiology in terms of psoriasis. And what you'll notice is that when we think of our TNF therapies, it is present in multiple different locations in the lesional skin, in the blood, and it's considered one of the workhorses when it was first introduced. Then we're talking about our IL-12/23 inhibitor or IL-23 inhibitor, very important in terms of limiting the Th17 population in the psoriasis pathogenesis. And then we have our IL-17 inhibitors in the skin, in the lesional skin, as well as in the blood. We have increased levels of IL-17, and therefore the anti-IL-17 therapies are highly effective. So as you can see, many of these therapeutic categories are shared. Now let's think about choosing a biologic. When we think about patients with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, TNF inhibitors, these are my thoughts, by the way, TNF inhibitors are great in both psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, but probably, in my opinion, greatest in psoriatic arthritis. Its efficacy in psoriasis, relatively speaking, is more modest compared to IL-17 and IL-23 classes. We want to avoid TNF inhibitors in those with demyelinating disease or hepatitis B. And then it's not preferred in those with a history of latent TB or potentially advanced CHF. What about our IL-17 inhibitors? IL-17 inhibitors as a class have robust efficacy in both the skin as well as the joints. And when we think about the joints, it helps with the different domains in terms of both peripheral psoriatic arthritis as well as axial disease. And as Dr. Ogdi has said, you want to avoid IL-17 inhibitors in those with a personal history of inflammatory bowel disease or not use therapies that are not indicated in that population, not indicated for IBD. And then other consideration is that there are low rates of oral candidiasis, especially with some of our newer IL-17 inhibitors where it has great efficacy in the skin, but carry now a greater risk of oral candidiasis. And then for our IL-23 inhibitors, overall as a class, there's a little bit more heterogeneity in the performance of the different IL-23 inhibitors. Guselkumab and risankizumab has very robust skin efficacy. A number of them are also approved for psoriatic arthritis, guselkumab, risankizumab, and ustekinumab. And one of the key advantages in terms of our IL-23 inhibitors is that they do have fewer injections, that our patients only need to take them either once every 2 months or once every 3 months. So they really like that option when I discuss that with them. In terms of axial disease, I think the evidence is evolving. And as was shown in the guidelines talk by Dr. Ogdi, that IL-23 inhibitors have not been incorporated in the treatment of axial disease in some of the guidelines. Okay, so since this is a hot topic, so I wanted to make sure that I include our newest FDA-approved biologic, which is bimekizumab. Bimekizumab differs from other IL-17 inhibitors in that it inhibits both IL-17A as well as IL-17F. And interestingly, IL-17F is actually expressed in higher amounts in the skin than IL-17A. And it's not bispecific. It inhibits both of these ligands by taking advantage of their similarity. So you can think about IL-17A and F as siblings. They have 50% homology. So bimekizumab takes advantage of that 50% homology, and it binds to a place where both IL-17A and IL-17F shares. So how well does it do? It has very, very high efficacy, likely the highest that we've seen so far in psoriasis. So, we talk about ACR20, for example, as the main primary endpoint. In skin now, we're talking about PASI 100, so complete clearance in patients who start out with moderate to severe disease. And by week 16, 2 out of 3 patients on bimekizumab will be completely clear. So this level of efficacy we haven't really seen before in the prior biologics, and it really sets the new standard in terms of clearance for skin. And it's very fast onset. Patients are able to see improvement within just 2 weeks of injection. Okay, so this one is a long-term comparative efficacy of biologics for moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. So if you wonder how do the biologics for psoriasis shakes out in terms of efficacy, there are a number of different meta-analysis that have been published. This one looks at the whole year. So this is looks at the first year of data and looks at the cumulative benefit. This one at the time was published. It did not include bimekizumab, but that newer publication, it's impressed right now. But as you can see, it often doesn't matter which network meta-analysis that you read. The top four always comes out to be around this area. So ixekizumab, brodalumab, risankizumab, and guselkumab in the skin, they work very, very well. And sometimes you may get a question like, which one is better? Is it ixekizumab or risankizumab? And there's no head-to-head data. And when your patient asks that, you say, yes. So, and you will be right because oftentimes their confidence intervals overlap. I think when bimekizumab in the latest one that's, that will be published hopefully in the coming months, I think bimekizumab will rank also definitely among the top. The debate is oftentimes what is at the very top, but given the data we have, oftentimes the confidence intervals may overlap. But the key thing is that we have very good medications, biologics for our patients. Okay, so overall, when you're just looking at skin disease alone, IL-17 inhibitors or IL-23 inhibitors are generally preferred over TNF inhibitors. We have a number of head-to-head trials, most of them against adalimumab, of IL-17 inhibitors against STAT or IL-23 inhibitors against adalimumab. So if you have a patient with mostly moderate to severe plaque psoriasis, then that's an area that's where the field's acknowledgement is. Okay, what about if you have a patient with a moderate to severe plaque psoriasis, but they have peripheral psoriatic arthritis? That's probably the most likely case that you're going to encounter. And when we think about that, I think about the ability of our biologics to inhibit radiographic progression. As you know, that this is showing modified total sharp score and the placebo showing here progression over time. And then here is secukinumab showing that at least during the short term, that there's overall no progression in the vast majority of our patients. And we see that with our other IL-17 inhibitors as well. Here's placebo showing slight progression, and the orange being ixekizumab, and the other ones representing adalimumab here showing no worsening of radiographic progression. What about bimekizumab? So we have data on bimekizumab, not yet approved for psoriatic arthritis, but certainly from the clinical trials, they have also shown overall radiographic progression was minimal during the first 16 weeks. So, as a result of that, so if you have a patient with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis and someone with peripheral psoriatic arthritis, in general, the current data shows that IL-17 inhibitors have stronger data with regards to prevention or retardation of the radiographic progression compared to IL-23 inhibitors. All right. What to do if you have a patient with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis and axial psoriatic arthritis? Now, there is a clinical trial actually looking at this particular question. And this clinical trial was comparing secukinumab versus placebo with regards to treating axial disease for in axial disease, axial psoriatic arthritis, or that particular domain for to evaluate their efficacy. And so here is the ASAS20 response. And so what they found was that secukinumab achieved, as you can see, ASAS20. Here's multiple imputation, or as observed, either way is more efficacious than placebo in terms of achieving ASAS20 in those with axial disease. So because of that, in general, at this time, IL-17 inhibitors have stronger data in terms of treatment of axial PSA compared to our IL-23 inhibitors. And that's why in the guidelines, you see that for patients with mostly axial disease, the IL-17 inhibitors are preferred. Now, TNF inhibitors can also be considered. In this case, if you have a patient with moderate to severe psoriasis, because IL-17 efficacy is better in the skin, that's why in those categories of patients, IL-17 inhibitors are preferred when you're combining the skin versus the joint data.
Okay, so let's address a few things from this great session by Dr. April Armstrong. I want to remind you of some key points. One, head-to-head data, it only exists in dermatology trials. There's very little head-to-head data in the way of arthritis outcomes, and there is some with TNF inhibitors and IL-17, suggesting IL-17 is better, but in the dermatology trials, IL-23 beats IL-17, but both of those are very high as far as the PASI 100, PASI 90 responses compared to everything else, right? And down the line is going to be, DMARDs and JAK inhibitors and whatnot. When she made the statement that IL-17 is preferred maybe in psoriatic arthritis because of radiographic data, I don't think I'd make that decision or make that judgment. I think the clinical outcome data, not considering the radiographics, still is equal as far as 17s and 23s and even the TNF inhibitors. So yes, skin, there's a clear hierarchy of all the drugs she's talking about. With joints, they're all about the same. TNF inhibitors, 17 inhibitors, the 23 inhibitors, and maybe to some extent the JAK inhibitors. And that's where the problem is. So for you, making the decisions can often hinge like on what the best drug is on how much skin involvement there may be. After that, the joint involvement, it may be pretty clear about what to do. We have a question, anonymous one from the audience saying, is there a benefit to using the term psoriatic disease compared to psoriatic arthritis or PSA? In these sessions, because we involve the dermatologists, and because I and Dr. Kavanaugh actively ask and want the dermatology data to be presented to you, so I think it's relevant to your practice, because many of us manage the skin disease and the joint disease. Psoriatic disease covers the spectrum of disease, which includes joints, includes the skin. Includes the very important issue of comorbidities, as was outlined really by both speakers here. I want to make one last point, and that is she's talked about drugs that they don't use. And I got to tell you, I use all of them. Leflunomide, I use it in skin psoriasis. It works just like methotrexate as an add-on. They don't use JAK in, I'm sorry, NSAIDs. We use NSAIDs to manage the arthritis. Prednisone, many rheumatologists are not afraid to use low-dose prednisone to manage difficult polyarticular psoriatic arthritis, and we don't see the horrors of, horrible flares of skin disease. That's really quite rare. Golimumab is a TNF inhibitor. I would use it if I had to. I agree that abatacept has little or no role in managing psoriatic disease, although it does have the indication, right? So again, if you have any questions, please be sure to put that up.
Okay. What
Oops.
about dope?
Be sure to put that up. We're going to move on to our third and final speaker. Again, this session sponsored by AbbVie. Thank you to AbbVie. This next talk I thought was, to me, the highlight of the meeting. It features Dr. Leahy Eder from the University of Toronto, who's associate professor at the University of Toronto, and we asked her to talk about the very hot topic of gender differences in psoriatic arthritis, meaning why do women do a whole lot worse? And she begins by basically saying there are a lot of disorders where there's a clear imbalance, actually, with more women being affected by many autoimmune diseases. And then she's going to get into the next slide, which talks about that men and women present differently with regard to PSA. So here we go, Dr. Lee Eder. Let's listen up.
But there are a lot of differences in the way it presents clinically. And there's been quite a lot of studies that show consistently that female patients tend to have higher scores in pain-sensitive domains. So they have higher tender joint count, higher enthesitis count, higher pain scores, and they also experience more physical dysfunction and fatigue and lower quality of life. Male patients with psoriatic arthritis, on the other hand, tend to have higher levels of CRP. They tend to have more restriction in the spine mobility, and they also have more severe psoriasis. There seems to be an equal prevalence of extra-articular manifestations like IBD and uveitis and similar swollen joint count between male and female patients. There are also differences in imaging findings, and this has been shown both in PSA as well as in axSpA, where male patients tend to develop more radiographic damage, and this could be seen both in the peripheral joints as well as in the spine. Male patients would have more radiographic sacroiliitis and would more likely to develop erosions over time. Now, why is this important? Because if we rely only on X-rays when we consider a diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis or axial SpA or PSA, we may miss more subtle disease that does not cause damage, maybe at earlier phases. And therefore, considering using more sensitive modalities like MRI and ultrasound in female patients may be a way for us to avoid this potential bias. And I'll talk about delays in diagnosis, and this might be one of the reasons why female patients tend to have longer delays for the diagnosis. It's also, of course, important to know the mimickers of sacroiliitis that are more common in female patients. In this case, osteitis condensus ileus, the sclerosis that can be seen in the iliac side of the sacroiliac joint, may be confused with sacroiliitis in female patients, and this may lead to misdiagnosis of patients as having axial SpA, while in fact this is not a real in diagnosis of axial SpA. So important to be aware of these differences. So I've shown you that there are differences in the clinical presentation. So what is driving these differences? This still remains unknown, but there are some common things that we, or some common knowledge that we could learn from other conditions. And pain is an important factor. I've shown you that women have higher scores of pain. They have more tender joint count. And generally speaking, it's been shown across different diseases that female patients tend to report higher scores in pain scores or pain levels across different types of rheumatic conditions. Also, in experimental pain models, female patients would tend to show lower pain thresholds. So this is, for example, is assessed when asking patients to place their hand in ice-cold water, and women will more likely to withdraw it sooner than male patients. It's also important to recognize that there are differences in the way men and women report pain. So female patients with established rheumatic diseases are more likely to report diffuse pain that we as rheumatologists may be considered to be atypical or related to fibromyalgia. So this could add to the confusion that we may have, but it's important to realize that the way men and women report pain and this atypical type of pain may be more common in women patients, even though they do have established inflammatory condition. And
Pain is, of course, a subjective factor, but it has a biology behind it. And with more recent data and research into differences, we start to understand that there are some qualitative differences in the way pain is transmitted from the periphery and processed in the central nervous system. So it's been shown, for example, that microglial cells are important in pain processing in male patients, while T cells are important in female patients, and that this influence is influenced by testosterone levels. So with lower testosterone levels, there is a shift toward this T cell predominant pain processing. And this is important because many of the basic science research is limited to male animal models, and if medications are targeting specific cells that or processes that are more predominant in male patients, this may miss important targets that are important in female patients, and medications that were designed may not work as well in female patients. So this is really just evolving, but there are some important differences in the biology here. But there are also some other gender-related factors, and this has to do with gender roles. And typically, in many societies, there are differences in the way boys and girls are brought up. With boys, there is a sort of an expectations in many societies that boys will endure pain, and showing pain might be considered as weakness. And for girls, it's okay to say that they have pain or report pain or verbalize it. And this may lead to differences in the way men and women report pain when they are grown up, where men may then be more inclined to report lower levels of pain or to ignore pain and endure it because it would be a sign of weakness. So it's important to know these differences and to realize that it's not just biology, it's a complex mechanism. I mentioned some differences in immune system. We have very little data. Most biomarker studies in psoriatic arthritis and axial SpA do not report the results by sex, and there is typically sort of looking at everyone together and assuming that the biology is similar. But this is a very interesting study that was done in axial SpA, showing that in fact there are some important differences in gene expression between male patients and female patients, showing that the Th17 pathway is more active in male patients with AS, while the Th1 pathway is similarly active in male and female patients. So while we have very little data at this point, there are some important clues that there are differences also in the biology, and this potentially might inform us in terms of development of biomarkers and maybe even selection of drugs. So how else these differences could influence our practice? This is one way. So what tools we use to measure disease activity? This is an example that has been studied a lot using BASDAI or ASDAS. BASDAI, as you know, both of them are tools that are used to assess disease activity in axial SpA to treat to target. BASDAI is based on these five questions, and on the other hand, ASDAS is a combination of patient-reported outcomes and CRP levels. It's been shown in multiple studies and in meta-analysis that BASDAI tend to be higher in female patients compared to male patients, while ASDAS tend to be equal, probably because of applying more weight to the back pain component, as well as including the CRP component here, which tends to be higher in male patients. So knowing which tool to use and the differences that can be found when we use these tools between males and females. Another example, this is a study that was just published on PSA, looking at two treatment targets, so in minimal disease activity, MDA, and DAPSA remission. And they compared the discrepancy between what the physician and the patient thought is remission compared to these cutoffs for these different tools. They showed First, that when looking at the physician as the gold standard for remission, both tools function about similarly, maybe a little bit more discrepancy for the female patients with the MDA, but certainly the MDA seem to be performing better than the DAPSA, showing less discrepancy between the cutoff and what the physician thought. But when looking at what the patient thought is remission, you can see here that while for the DAPSA, both of these tools, the DAPSA and the MDA, both of them seem to be reasonable in terms of achieving these sensitivity and specificity targets for male patients, for female patients, there was a more discrepancy with the DAPSA score. So the bottom line is that we're just starting to look at these differences and what cutoff and should we be using different cutoff for males and females? Should we think about different targets, different tools? This has been sort of ignored so far, but there are some clear differences that we may need to be think about in the future. Another area that there has been studied for differences in sex differences in rheumatology is the diagnostic delays. And we know that this is a big issue and big problem in axial SpA. And it's been shown consistently that female patients tend to have a longer time to diagnosis compared to male patients with over 2 years difference. We've looked at it in the Ontario data looking at RA, PSA, and axSpA, and the time to the diagnosis, especially the journey that the patient goes through until they actually receive a diagnosis of these conditions. And we looked at the 3 years prior to the time they received a diagnosis and looking at visits to family physicians for non-specific musculoskeletal symptoms. So many of the patients are seeing their family physicians and are being referred to physio or to other physicians or to rheumatology. And we were interested to see whether there are differences in males and females. As you can see here, we did find that there was a slight difference across these different diseases with about 10 to 15% higher visits or more visits to family physicians up to 3 years prior to the diagnosis. But this was a relatively small difference. The bigger difference here was actually visits to rheumatologists. We found that between 50% to twofold higher chances females were more likely to visit the rheumatologist, but did not receive a concrete diagnosis of inflammatory arthritis, which means that probably women require more visits to rheumatologists until the rheumatologist is confident enough to make a diagnosis of these conditions. And you can see that the differences were particularly higher for axSpA and for PSA. So why is that? There are several potential reasons. I mentioned the use of imaging. It's possible that female patients are seeing rheumatologists sooner, maybe at an earlier stage of the disease before there are very clear signs of inflammation, maybe the way they report pain, maybe some comorbidities, and maybe the way rheumatologists interpret the symptoms might be different in males and females. But I want to also mention biases because I think this is important for us to be aware of our own biases as human beings. We all have biases. And this is the slide that I showed you before. If we assume that men are strong and brave, that maybe if they see us, then it must be real. And if women, it must be their anxiety that is acting up. So I mean, it's important to be aware of this, and there is data to support that the fact that there are differences in the way clinicians are in managing men and women, with more women receiving psychosomatic diagnosis for musculoskeletal pain. Women are less likely to receive effective pain relief medications, and more women with chronic pain feel more mistrusted by their physicians. So I mean, as clinicians, we need to be aware of our own biases, and that's the first step to try and mitigate these biases. Finally, I wanted to discuss this really exciting topic of sex-related differences in treatment response, because I think this is where in the future we might consider also using sex as a way to inform selection of treatment. So there is very little consideration of sex in the development of pharmaceutical or drugs, starting from basic science to phase one and phase two trials. And that mainly to the fact that most of the prescription drugs that are withdrawn from the market, it's because of safety issues in that is greater in female patients. And we typically don't consider sex when we prescribe medication, but this is one unusual case where the FDA approved different doses for Zopiclone, which is a sleeping pill, and recommending starting at a lower dose for female patients because of safety issues. So this is an unusual example, but we typically, there is a gap of data that we just don't know what whether to consider sex when we prescribe the drugs. So what do we know about medications and a response to treatment in PSA? Most of the data is coming from observational studies, and most of the studies have done on were done on TNF inhibitors. This is one example, but most of the studies were pretty consistent in the results showing lower effectiveness in female patients, with female patients less likely to achieve efficacy endpoints in the short term, but also lower persistence of TNF inhibitors in female patients. And females are more likely to stop these medications because of both inefficacy as well as adverse effects. So this has been shown in multiple studies in PSA.
So let's stop there. She goes on to show you the same thing for the IL-17 inhibitors, the IL-12/23, basically that women don't do as well in most of the therapies we use. Interestingly, she also showed the data that men and women respond equally with PSA to JAK inhibitors. And that is sort of an unusual and interesting finding. So I think that that is worth noting, and watching this data, she is beginning a very big study that we hope to hear more about in years to come, that will shed more light as to the gender differences in the psoriatic arthritis and spondyl arthritis, especially with regard to therapies. So we'll look forward to that. If you want to see Dr. Eder's full lecture, it's on Room Now right now. It's also on the YouTube channel for you to view the full lecture. There are a few of these lectures that are also available in podcasts. So Dr. April Armstrong's lecture is available as a podcast, I think beginning tomorrow, along with the panel discussion. So we had a panel discussion after these three lectures of Ogbe, Armstrong, and Eder. We had a 30-minute Q&A session with the audience, and that was a very lively session, and you can listen to that also on the podcast channel. That'll be up, I think, tomorrow or sometime this week. That's one of the things we do at Room Now. We like the audience, the speakers, to give us not an hour lecture, not a half hour lecture, 25 minutes and 5 minutes of questions. And then we get them again with 30 minutes. So in a 120-minute session, we have 45 minutes devoted to Q&A. We want to thank the sponsor, AbbVie, for being the prime sponsor at Room Now Live. I think that their involvement has been critical. Critical to the success of what we're doing. I want to remind you of next week's program. We have another program where next week we're going to talk about the vasculitis topic. And so you can see this is a general schedule. We have 5 weeks every Tuesday night throughout April. Next week is vasculitis, week after spondyl arthritis, and the final week is going to be on lupus. I want to review for you a few questions that we threw out. Over 150 people responding to the survey that went out yesterday on psoriatic arthritis and psoriatic disease questions. First question is, what's the primary target and treat to target in psoriatic arthritis? And most of you chose minimal disease activity, MDA, but in fact, the guidelines often make it remission is the right lecture, a right answer for the preponderance of evidence that's out there in the literature. Second question, what's the first step in determining the appropriateness of psoriasis therapy. And Dr. Armstrong said, number one, its body surface area is the main thing that you want to look at. And I think that most of you got that right. And the third question here is, what class of biologic agent is recommended for those who have robust psoriasis or a very active psoriasis and very active psoriatic arthritis? What gives you the best response? You chose correctly IL-23 inhibitors because mainly of the advantage in psoriasis, right? But if this was just a question about which biologic agent was more effective amongst these IL-23, 17, 20, 12, 23s, and TNF, they would all be equal. So I think that's worth keeping in mind. Two more questions. Which of the following oral medications is FDA approved for all of the severities of psoriasis? And the right answer here is apremilast. Many of you chose upadacitinib, but apremilast is the right answer, even though we think of that as being only a mild disease drug. It's actually indicated in all severities and actually has multiple indications. And palmoplantar psoriasis, what drug is most effective? The right answer, according to Dr. Armstrong, was TYK2 inhibition. You chose, rheumatologist, half of you chose IL-23. We learned from Dr. Ken Gordon last year, it's JAK inhibitors in general. So I would have accepted the right answer be JAK inhibitors, which 23% of you got right, or TYK2, which is what Dr. Armstrong was suggesting, and 9% of you got that right. Next week, our session is about vasculitis. We have three great speakers. Dr. Cassie Sims from Duke is talking about vasculitis and pregnancy. Dr. Anisha Dua from Northwestern talking about GPA management. And Dr. Philip Seo from Hopkins talking about treat to target in vasculitis. If no questions, we'll move on. And thank you for participation. Tell your colleagues about this. If you register for Room Now Live next year, you get full access to all the lectures, all the downloads. We also have a bunch of board questions, almost 170 board questions from these sessions for people to participate. You'll get that if you're a full registrant. Take care. Have a great week. We'll see you next Tuesday night.